Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, I'm on. Okay. I thought the lady was going to talk. She's already done.
That's because I was chatting at you during the break.
Yeah, you were.
You didn't hear any of it.
888-914-9149. Have an email. I've got tons of emails. This one's from Phyllis listening in Philadelphia. She says, I'm so glad you talked about purgatory. I think it was yesterday that I did. It seems that many Catholics don't believe in it anymore, but instead they believe that everyone who dies goes to heaven. The Protestant once saved, always saved notion. She said, that's sad. My husband died 3 years ago, and I pray constantly for his soul, even though he was a pious and faithful, loving Catholic. I pray for the souls of all the deceased, no matter how long they've been gone. How hard is it to spend time praying for those who have gone on, and as I say, just in case? Pray that more priests will ask us to pray for the departed souls at funerals. Something like that is lost, unfortunately. I think you're definitely right about that, Phyllis. It seems to me that certainly in the last, maybe say since the Second Vatican Council, there's been a real de-emphasis on our duty to pray for those who have died. I mean, we say it like, may he rest in peace, but think about what that means. To say rest in peace, that means, you know, if you're not in peace now, I hope you're resting in peace now. Or in this life, maybe you didn't have any peace or it was difficult for you. I hope that now you're resting in peace. So it's an expression of hope. What that means is that's from the Catholic Church, by the way, that whole requiescat in pace, rest in peace. The pace means that you're resting in the peace of the Lord. So when you say, may he rest in peace, it's in reality, it is an implicit invocation of a prayer for that person if he or she is in purgatory. If he's in heaven, he's already at peace. He's with Jesus face to face forever. But if he's not there yet, and we're going to assume that he didn't go to hell, please God, so if he's destined for heaven and he needs your prayers because he's still in purgatory and he's not resting yet, well, may he rest in peace. Lord, please shorten the time that he's in purgatory. So I'm with you. I agree that we should be more attentive to this. I'm sorry to see that in my lifetime, basically the whole span of my lifetime, maybe a little bit less, we have seen a great de-emphasis on the holy souls in purgatory. So to whatever little extent I can be part of the movement back in the direction of encouraging people to pray for the souls of the faithful departed, that perpetual light may shine upon them and that they may in fact rest in peace. You have a really important role to play there. And all the more so because if you teach your children and your grandchildren and those around you to pray for the holy souls, don't forget that when it's your time, if you happen to go to purgatory, they will be in the habit of praying for you. What a terrible thing if you pass on and because there was never that spirituality in your home and none of your kids or anybody else really remembers to pray for you, imagine if you're languishing in purgatory for lack of people to pray for you. So I think you get the idea. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Alvin, Texas, and talk to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was listening earlier. You were talking about the boundaries with the cell phones and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
And I was just thinking about how times have changed. When I was, I'm 68, so that was a long time ago, but I was 16 years old. I wanted a car. So my dad said, well, save up the money and you can get yourself a car. Well, I saved up the money, and I still had to ask his permission on which car to get. Can you imagine doing that nowadays?
Did you have to get his permission, or did you just want his guidance or his advice?
Maybe a little of both, but no, if it was a car he didn't want me to get, I couldn't have got it.
Oh.
And I knew it, you know? Mm-hmm. Of course, the good part is it was kind of a hot rod, and I think his cousin told him, get that car for that boy, and he will never forget it. So.
Remember that song? My daddy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln. Remember that song?
Exactly. Well, it was actually a 69 Roadrunner.
Oh. Bet you wish you still had that thing, don't you?
Yes, I do. But I was thinking about what parents are up against today. And with my own son, I tried to have good boundaries. And he's a good guy. But I could have done a little bit better, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think we live in a world where everybody wants to be the nice guy. You know, my dad used to say, if you don't like it, leave. People say, what a horrible thing to do, but actually it was a good thing to do.
If you don't like this house you're living in, if you don't like the food you're eating, if you don't like the electricity that you're using, then here's the door, right? That's what he was saying to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't imagine people can't hardly believe saying that nowadays, though. It's weird, you know. Everybody wants to be Mr. Nice Guy.
Well, I'm trying to find, and I hope I did, I'm not so sure sometimes, but I tried to find a happy medium between dad, who is just and no nonsense, but also dad, who is loving and forgiving and fun and approachable. And so I was always looking for that golden mean between the two. Sometimes I think I got closer to it than other times. But as you look back on life, Mark, and you look back and say, well, I wish I had done things differently, or I could have done more of this or less of that. I think that's part of life, because my guess is that in the moment you were probably making a good faith effort to do the best you could based upon what you saw. And then as you look back, you say, I probably should have done it differently. But that's just life, I think.
Yeah. But anyway, I really appreciate your program. And you have a bunch of real good conversation with people.
You know, thank you, Mark.
Calling in your conversation, too.
Thank you. Well, this is one of those conversations, if you ask me. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Go down to Texas City, Texas now, and go to Jessica. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I had a real fast question. I just had a friend call me, and she says she wants to quit taking her medicine because she is tired of feeling pain. And she asked me if that was committing suicide. And I didn't know how to answer her. Mm. And I told her I would get back with her because I had to call you first.
Okay. Well, so, thank you. Thank you.
Tell me.
I'll do my best.
Okay, tell me.
Yeah. Okay, sure. No, I don't think it is. But I have a couple quick questions. How old is she, first of all, and what are her circumstances? Is she a widow? Does she have children? Is she?
She is not widowed. She has children. She has grandchildren that she watches every day. Her husband comes home to her every day.
How old
is
she?
She's not widowed. She's just, 55.
Oh, she's young.
Yes.
And is she suffering from a terminal illness, or is she just not feeling well? She's feeling poorly.
No, she is suffering from just numerous things that make her feel horrible. And she has to take medication. If she doesn't take medication, it could get worse.
Okay.
And then if it gets worse, well, then she's just in more pain. And that's why
is it life-threatening?
It is, yes.
So if she stops the medication, whatever she's taking the medication for would eventually kill her.
Correct. And okay. It might take a week, and it might take 2 months, which is more suffering anyway.
I see. Yes. It's a difficult situation. And I've never been in that situation. So I can only approach it from the standpoint of, you know, what are the principles at work here? So let's talk about that. It's not strictly speaking suicide, because it is, although the net effect would be the same and she would die, she's not taking her own life. She's not ending her life the way a suicide would do. Rather, she's choosing not to treat the illness with a medicine, which is not an extraordinary means of preserving life, but I think it's something more toward an extraordinary measure. you're doing something out of the ordinary. If you're taking medicine that's life-saving, that's out of the ordinary. If you don't take this medicine because you might die, that is out of the ordinary. So we could say, in a sense, that's extraordinary. She's not obligated to pursue extraordinary means to stay alive. So I don't think it would be suicide. Really, I think that the issue is, what would God have you do in the here and now? That's why I was asking about her state in life and if she had children. So if she were, let's change the scenario a little bit. If this woman were 33 and she had four children or five children and a husband, and she said, well, you know, I've got type 1 diabetes and I need to take the insulin shot. And if I don't take the insulin shot, I'll go into a diabetic coma and I will die. Well, in her case, although that wouldn't be suicide, it would be, in my view at least, that it would be terribly irresponsible, terribly wrong to do that, because her children need her. Her husband needs her. She has obligations that if she said, well, I'm not going to take my insulin anymore and I'm just going to allow myself to die, I would say that would be a sin of a different kind. So in her case, even though she's not elderly, I think something similar applies there. I think, you know, your husband loves you and he wants to be with you, and your children and now your grandchildren and other people who really do care about you. And although you don't have the same obligations to them that you would if you were a 33-year-old young mom with a baby on your hip, nonetheless, you still have certain obligations to these people who love you and care about you. So in charity, if nothing else, the better thing to do is to, you know, push forward and maybe talk to the doctors and see if there's a different regimen of medical therapy or of drugs, medicines that you could take that will help you so you don't feel terrible. They can adjust things. Maybe there's a way to do that. But I think that if I were in your position, Jessica, trying to give her advice, I would say it's not technically suicide, but it's still not the right thing to do, for the reasons I just mentioned, and try to give her some encouragement and some hope to say you have so much to live for and so many people who love you, and think of all the sadness that you would cause and all the other problems that could arise because you decided to allow your life to end sooner than you would have if you maintained this medical therapy and taking the medicines and things like that. I would try to approach her along those lines. If that makes sense.
Well, it's like I told her, we talk all the time, and I said, and I would miss your phone calls, and if I could miss your phone calls, I can imagine what your family would miss.
Yeah.
So
indeed.
Yeah.
Maybe what she needs, Jessica, is a big old heaping helping of encouragement. That might be what she's lacking right now. Nobody has really encouraged her to be brave and courageous and generous. These are all virtues that, I don't know if she has them or not, but maybe you're in her life for that reason so that you can encourage her to do that.
Well, here I go, because I'm going to go see her today, and she's going to get it.
Good. Yeah, and just
thank you
let
so
her
much
know.
For taking my call.
You got it. And let her know that all of us here at Relevant Radio and a whole bunch of people who are listening right now are going to be praying for her and also for you.
Thank you. God
will help you help her.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate that so much.
You're welcome, Jessica. Good talking to you. And I sure hope that things go in a positive direction here. I have a feeling they will. I really do. Let's go now to Milwaukee and talk to Dave. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Certainly.
My question today is kind of regarding my marriage and my faith.
Okay.
My wife and I have been married for just about 11 years. Our anniversary is tomorrow. She
Congrats.
Grew up Lutheran. I grew up Catholic. Thank you.
Okay.
We went through the marriage prep courses with both the Lutheran and the Catholic Church. And at the end of the prep course for the Catholic Church, our priest told us that she was not welcome in the church.
Did he say why?
Because she's Lutheran.
There's got to be something more to it than that. I mean, you were there, I guess, when he said this, right?
Right. Yeah. No, we were there.
What provoked him? What a crazy thing to say.
I'm
what provoked
sure.
him to say that?
I know. I'm not sure. We got all the way through, and at the end, he said, "You are not welcome in the church." So, I mean, I guess long story short, it caused me to leave the faith. Partly due to your show, I've come back. It's causing some.
I'm happy to hear that.
Issues. Yeah. So.
But wait, let's go back. Here, just rewind the tape. Rewind. I need to come back to this. I'm trying to wrap my head around this. So the priest said after she went through RCIA, he told her to her face, "You're not welcome."
Not the RCIA. It was the marriage prep course.
Okay, marriage prep.
We got married. So
you had met with him X number of times over a period of months for the marriage prep, right?
Correct.
Okay, so then he says to her, and you're there, can you repeat to me what you remember him saying?
I remember him saying, "You are not welcome in the Catholic Church."
And then what? Have
both
a nice day? What did he do?
He's
like, turned around and walked away?
I mean,
or what?
Nobody knew what to say. We both went out and sat out in the car and cried.
Okay, so Dave, please understand, I'm not badgering you, and it's not that I don't believe you. I'm flabbergasted by this. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around how and why a Catholic priest could say something so...
It's been hard.
Yeah, okay. So let's put on our thinking caps here. I don't know, and maybe you'll never know, what would provoke a priest to say something that... I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, that destructive and that hurtful. So since we may never know, maybe he was having a bad day, maybe, you know, who knows what was going on in his life. I would say just steer around that priest, go to a different parish, let Father McGillicuddy know, here's what happened. It was really hurtful. We don't want to go back there. It just was insane, and we don't even know what to make of it, but we want to make a fresh start. We really want to live in the Catholic Church. What do we need to do? Father McGillicuddy, help us. And I'm sure he will. And just maybe the simplest way is just go to a different parish and start
and
fresh.
I have done that. I'm in a new parish. Do you have any
she doesn't want to be Catholic,
get
right?
My wife.
She doesn't want to be Catholic.
Not anymore. She doesn't want to be.
Well, that's a whole repair job in itself, you know, and I'm not sure how to repair the damage that priest did, but I think I would be saying to her, honey, that was just a fluke. And what he said, that was coming out of some weird place in his own mind. That's not the Catholic Church speaking. And what he said to you does not reflect the Catholic Church's desire that you should become a Catholic and that we would welcome you with open arms and be grateful for you becoming Catholic. Please understand, honey, that was not the Catholic Church speaking. I would really try to help her see that. Probably you already have. But the other thing is that maybe this other priest, whoever he may be, he may help you do that and just help her see, you know what, I'm so sorry that you were wounded that way. He should not have done it. I wish he hadn't done it. But look, let's start over again. That's not the Catholic Church. That's just some strange guy having a bad day. Maybe there's some way to resolve it that way. So ultimately, though, I feel as though maybe I'm missing the ultimate question that you're asking me. Are you asking for what to do, or is there something more to it?
Kind of what to do. My wife also deals with depression pretty heavily. Lately, I think because of my decision to come back to the Catholic Church, she's been saying things like she doesn't know if our marriage can handle that change. I'm wondering if you have any advice on kind of how to handle that, maybe help her in the process too.
I think that's something that a marriage and family therapist would be in a position to help. So to talk it through together with somebody who is, you know, qualified. I'm not qualified in that area, but I would say get in touch with your archdiocese, the Department of Family Life. It'll probably have some specific name, but something along those lines. And then ask them for a referral for a good Catholic therapist in your area, and then make an appointment and sit down and start the process, because usually things like this can be resolved if you get into that kind of a therapeutic scenario where you can talk it out and get everything out on the table and somebody can help guide you, you know, I think that would be a good step.
Okay. I will definitely try that. I've suggested, you know, like couples therapy in the past too, and that hasn't gone over so well either. So I will.
Do you have children?
We do. Yes. Two young kids.
Okay. So you and your wife then are young enough that, you haven't been married all that long. You have kids, and you're still, you know, in parenting mode and all of that. So that's a lot right there. Yeah. So we'll give that a try. Give that a try. Okay. Approach the Archdiocese, and I would plug in and then see. Then you evaluate again. Maybe try the therapy approach for a few sessions, 2, 3, 4, 5, see what happens. And then you can evaluate, is this helping? And if it's not helping, or if it's not helping as fast as you might want, then you can make a few calibrations. But I think that would be a good next step, if you ask me.
Okay, that sounds great. I appreciate your help and advice.
You're welcome, Dave. Hang in there. Hang in there. And keep praying for your wife. I'm sure you do. Just keep praying for her. Be patient with her. Love her. Don't do anything that might make that earlier wound flare up again. Let her see the beautiful face of the Catholic Church in you. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Welcome to the 1970s. I feel like I'm in the 70s when I hear this song. 888-914-9149. Email came in from Adelso, listening on the Relevant Radio app. Patrick, I have a simple question. When we die, do we have the same clothes we die with? Meaning, like, on our soul figure, do we have the same haircut that we had at the moment of death? Just wondering. Thank you. Well, Adelso, I haven't been there yet, so I can't say with experience, but I'm pretty confident that no. See, you're not going to have clothes or your wristwatch or any of those things that you have in this life. When you die and your body and soul separate, you're a disembodied soul. Now, what will that look like? So when you see other disembodied souls in the afterlife, what will that look like? Well, I think they will look like the body we have now. But as for things like haircut, who's to say? No way of knowing. Wouldn't it be funny if you had a full head of hair and you get into the afterlife and now you're bald? Or what if you're bald now and you have a full head of hair when you get into the afterlife? Who knows? I really don't know. But I can tell you that as a disembodied spirit, you won't need clothes. Now, will that mean that you'll appear naked? I don't know. There's no way to know, really. I should think that if we're looking at like the saints in heaven, I'm pretty sure that they're wearing garments, you know, that even though there's no room anymore for things like unchastity or impurity or anything like that, I think the dignity of the body and the beauty of clothing on the body is what you would see in heaven. So these are just assumptions, but my sense of it is that when you go into the afterlife as a disembodied soul, before you receive your body back in the general judgment, yeah, probably you will appear to other people with some sort of apparel, some sort of garment, but we won't know for sure till we get there. Now, I appreciate the email, Adelso. Now, here's an email that just came in, and this is from Eric listening in Denver. Thanks for sending it, Eric. He's referring to the rude priest that the caller a moment ago was talking about. He says, the first thought that came to mind was, don't let a Catholic get in the way of your Catholicism. Poor couple, that priest did more damage than good. And that may well be the case. But here's another thought that was rolling around in my brain over the break here. What if the gentleman who called in and said that the priest told his wife, Lutheran wife, after they had gone through marriage prep, that you're not welcome in the Catholic Church. Another way to interpret that is, is it possible that maybe he said, you can't receive communion in the Catholic Church? Now, that's not saying you can't be in the Catholic Church. It's not saying you're not welcome in the Catholic Church. But it's possible that maybe that's what he said, and that's how she interpreted it. I don't know. And, of course, how you say something like that can mean all the difference. So that's another possibility, and I didn't get a chance to ask that question, but you never know. Lastly, this comes in from Emily this morning, listening in Sacramento on our 1620 AM station. She says, good morning, wonderful. Hello. Good morning, beautiful Patrick and Cyrus. I hope you're having a wonderful day this morning thus far. You're always so inspiring and wonderful. Thank you for your time today. Well, gosh, I feel very uplifted, Cyrus, don't you?
That's Isn't that really nice? Yeah, I thought it read, good morning, beautiful Patrick and Cyrus.
Well, the subject line says, good morning, wonderful. So I didn't know whether I'm wonderful and you're beautiful. That's probably what she meant. I'm wonderful and you're beautiful. Or something.
That's nice. I need to drink whatever coffee she's drinking. That's what I need.
I'll have a second cup of that. Thank you, Emily. We reciprocate. Thank you. Back to the phones. Let's go now to, is it Andrea or Adria in Salt Lake City?
Adria.
Adria. All right. Third time's a charm.
Good morning. I also had a comment for the gentleman who called about his wife and the Lutheran Church. I didn't have the exact same situation, but I had something similar, and I thought this might help. About 20 years ago, my husband was trying to join our CIA. We had young kids, and, you know, I told him we had to raise them Catholic, and he was on board with that all along, but he felt like, you know, I probably should also become Catholic myself, you know, so we can do this as a family.
Yeah.
He was in our CIA, but at the time, his job required him to travel 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they had originally told him they would work with him with that type of schedule. They said he could meet with a nun when he was back in town to catch up on what he missed, and then he would have to go to the classes when he was in town. And he did that for, I don't know, about a month or so, maybe 2 months, and then all of a sudden they said, we decided that you're not with the class enough, you can't do this anymore. And it really rubbed him the wrong way that they wouldn't work with him. He thought, wow, you know, I want to do this and they're not allowing me. And after that, he was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And he was really turned off. He would still go to Mass with us a couple times a year, but wouldn't stay in us for that. And it was hard, you know, but for many, many years we did this. And my oldest son was a teenager at this point, and he and I went to a retreat where we learned more about the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and we started to pray Divine Mercy for my husband. And what was really interesting is the first time we did it, my husband the next day said, what did you guys do? And I was like, why? And he said, I woke up in a cold sweat seeing that image you showed me on that card. And we just thought, okay, that's really neat, you know. Yeah.
It happened that fast.
That was the first thing. Yeah, that was the first thing. But then we also did a consecration to our Blessed Mother. We did the 33 days to Morning Glory.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I asked for her intercession on was for her to help me bring my husband to her son. And gosh, it was within a couple months of that my husband it was actually around the Feast of Juan Diego, he all of a sudden felt a little bit more drawn to watch this documentary about Our Lady of Guadalupe. And he didn't know why. He started to watch it. He didn't know any of this, that I was praying for this, but he started to watch it. And he thought, why am I watching this? I'm not interested in that. And he turned it off. And then a couple of days later, he just felt really drawn to finish watching it.
Okay.
And after he watched all the miracles about Our Lady of Guadalupe, he was like, it was just like a light went off, and he was like, I need to convert. I need to do this.
Nice.
Our Lady is asking me to do this, and I can't say no. I need to do it. And it was just like night and day. I couldn't believe it. This is after 20 years of him completely rejecting it, or almost 20. It was more like 19 years. But it was just like a light went off for him. And what was really neat is he realized, one of the things that made him realize this was not just him, this was divine intervention, was that it was on the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe is when this happened.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Ever since then,
and no surprise.
Yeah, he got back into RCIA. Yeah, he got back into RCIA. He last year, or it's been over a year now, Easter of, I think it was 2021, he got, you know, he finally became Catholic. And ever since, he's had a very strong relationship with our Blessed Mother. He, you know, he goes to Mass with me every Sunday now. He's finally that Catholic father figure we've wanted in our family all along. And it's just made such a big difference. And so I thought I would share that story with the gentleman who called in, because I thought, you know, I've been through it, and I
I'm
just
so glad
to
you
that
did.
Maybe if he starts doing that, you know, maybe asking our Blessed Mother and also maybe praying Divine Mercy Chaplet for her. But maybe
I think that's a great, oh, excuse me. I think that's a great suggestion, Adria. Very happy outcome to that. By the way, and thanks for sharing that with people, I don't know if you're familiar with an organization in the great state of Utah called Catholic Utah. Their website is catholicutah.org. I used to recommend them rather frequently, and then a little thing called COVID hit. and so their speaking again, events, they were curtailed for a time, but I think they're back in action now. But it's a great support group for Catholics in Utah, and they have resources and some get-togethers and meetings and all sorts of interesting things. Their website is catholicutah.org, catholicutah.org. If you're a Catholic and you're in Utah and you want some community with other Catholics, check it out, catholicutah.org. Thank you so much, Adria. Let's go now to Tim in Rochelle, Illinois. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Patrick. What yokes us together as believers when it comes to basic beliefs, basic Christian beliefs that Catholics follow and that non-Catholics follow? I was raised in a semi-Catholic kind of family, nothing too strenuous. I was an absolute non-believer in anything. I probably believed in fairies and gnomes and goblins more than I believed in Jesus and all that stuff. And I'm now well into life. I'm on that top of the hill kind of age. But I look around and I see fantastic Christians in so many different expressions that, I mean, I have kind of coined a term that I think is a correct Christian, and a correct Christian lives a certain way. And I appreciate, as I study Christianity and the history of it, which you had a commercial running about how important it is to learn the history of the faith, the Catholics really do the best job of seeing what happened at the very beginning of the church era to right now as one continuous act. You know, if we're all in this together, whether it's 80, 90, or whether it's 2022, this is what we do as Christians. Reason being is I studied the history of exposure.
So, Tim, let me just jump in. I want to make sure I'm following. So you started to say what yokes us or what binds us, and I'm interested in what you meant by that. Could you
Catholics
explain?
And non-Catholics. I don't like the term Protestants because there's nothing in the Catholic. I don't like the word Protestant because I'm not protesting anything in 2022.
Oh, okay. So you yourself are not Catholic. Did I misunderstand?
Right. I am not Catholic.
Got it.
I absolutely
okay.
And utterly respect a lot of what Catholics do. There's
Got
some
it.
Things that would be disingenuous for me to go to a Catholic mass or become a Catholic. There's just some things I just can't agree with.
Well, maybe at the moment, Tim, but if I do my job right, maybe 6 months or a year from now or 5 years from now, you might feel differently. Fair enough.
Okay.
But in any case, though, so
you guys got Peter Kraft. So if you got Peter, you know, he was my favorite apologist for brought me to the faith, kind of. So.
And you know, he used to be an evangelical Protestant. He was actually a Calvinist.
I know.
Yeah.
I
He's
know.
A good man. So here, if I'm understanding your question correctly, what yokes us or what links us? We have, number one, a common ancestry. Whether we use the term Protestant, whatever term you prefer, either way, this grievous and I would say scandalous division in the church that arose 500 years ago that was propelled by Catholics, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and several other prominent figures in the Protestant Reformation, they originally were Catholic. And you know the story, you know what happened there. But this was a division and a wound in the body of Christ that has never healed. But to answer your question, what are the things that yoke us? Number one, we have a common ancestry, that we all used to be together in the Catholic Church that stretches back to the time of Christ and the apostles. And all polemics aside about things that we agree on or disagree on, the fact is that's a real shame that we no longer have that unity that, that Christ, as you know, desires for all of his followers, John chapter 17. So that's one thing. Another thing we have in common is the Holy Bible. And we can turn to the Holy Bible and look to it for solutions for some of these things that we disagree with. I would point out respectfully that the one thing that doesn't help is the idea of Scripture alone, because the Bible doesn't teach that. It doesn't teach that we should go by Scripture alone. In fact, it says the opposite in places like 2 Thessalonians 2:15, where we're told to stand firm and hold fast to the traditions as they were taught to us, either by an oral statement, apostolic tradition, or by a letter of ours, the Holy Gospels and the letters and epistles in the New Testament. We have that in common, so we can at least turn to Scripture and help sift through some of these issues. We also have the benefit of church history. We can compare our understandings of what the Bible means with how did the earliest Christians understand it? What were they saying about things like the Eucharist or baptism, etc., in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century? That's a help to us, so we have a common history we can turn back to there. And then lastly, we have, and this is my hope for everyone on either side of this issue, and that is we have good faith and charity toward one another, that we seek God's will to be done. We seek the good of the other person, and I'm quite confident, Tim, that you feel the same way about me or any other Catholic. So it seems like we have a lot there that we can build upon and draw upon, and hopefully maybe we'll live to see a reunion so that this grievous division in the body of Christ goes away. That's my prayer.
I would hope, and that is certainly my prayer. There's just, like I said, there are some things that I would respectfully have to get up and walk out of if I was in a, like I did once. A friend of mine brought me to a mass, and it was the Assumption of Mary, and I didn't get up and leave, but I was like, very disturbed by the I was so disturbed that the archbishop of that diocese actually sat down and met with me to answer my questions about what I had problems with. It was pretty wonderful.
That's good. Yeah.
So I mean, I don't see any division when it comes to the core beliefs of what it is to be a believer that separates us.
I do.
There's certain procedures, I think.
I'll tell you one that I do. Something to ponder anyway. And I have to take a break. I apologize, Tim. I'm right at that point. But as you and I both read John chapter 6, the second half of the chapter, Jesus says, "My flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life within him. He who does not eat my flesh, does not drink my blood, does not have life within him." As a Catholic, I see that clearly as Jesus teaching the Holy Eucharist and the real presence in the Holy Eucharist, his real presence. That's a distinctive area where there's a great division, largely between most Protestant folk, most evangelical folk, and the Catholic Church. So I don't say that as a challenge, other than to say that there's something where if the Catholic Church is right about that, and I firmly believe it is, then think of all that you're missing by not receiving the very body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. That in itself, to me, is like, what a crying shame, to use the term again, that our friends in your world, if I can use that term, are missing out on such an important blessing that Jesus himself said is so necessary. Here's a thought. I'm glad you're listening to the program. I hope you'll keep listening. I hope you'll call me back. I'd love to talk to you again. And in the meantime, maybe pick up a book by a former evangelical Protestant. His name is Tim Staples. He works at Catholic Answers, and he wrote a book called Behold Your Mother. And he goes into Scripture, and he talks about, among other things, the Assumption of Mary. So since that issue was disturbing to you, I think it would be well worth your time to take a look at how he explains that. And as I say, he used to be an evangelical Protestant. So take a look at that book. It's called Behold Your Mother by Tim Staples. I'm coming right back. Thank you, Tim. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're back, but we don't have much time. So call 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I feel like I'm in the discotheque with the platform shoes and the angel flight suit, puka shells and feathered hair. It's bringing me back. I like it. I don't wear puka shells anymore, by the way. Let's go to Doug in Wildomar, Minnesota. Welcome, Doug.
Hello, Patrick. My question is, unfortunately, there's been a lot of people that have, in my sphere, that have gotten cancer, and they've decided, some of them have decided to fight it very nobly and courageously. Mm-hmm. But one had a malignant brain tumor that was inoperable, and they chose to just not go through the medical field and go through all of the chemicals and the radiation and those kinds of things, and just died a natural death. Mm-hmm. My question was, should that happen to me or a Catholic person, would that be a sin or considered to be a form of suicide if they decided, hey, it's, you know, if they didn't have other responsibilities? I heard another caller earlier call about a person that was sick with diabetes, I think it was, and they just didn't want to continue to take their medicine. But in this case, if they didn't have a lot of other responsibilities and so forth, is that considered to be a mortal sin, or is it considered to be suicide?
No, on both counts.
Or is it just okay?
Yeah, it's not a sin, because, first of all, you're not doing anything wrong. If you have a serious life-threatening illness like that, and I think you said somebody who's maybe older, doesn't have any children at home, is not responsible for things that a young father or mother would be responsible for, just looking at it from that standpoint, no. I mean, we're not obligated. You're not obligated to exhaust every possible measure to prolong your life. So if that includes chemotherapy or radiation or an operation or something like that, those are available to you, and it's licit to pursue that if you choose to do so, but you're not committing a sin by not doing so. You can just simply say, Lord, thy will be done. And I just don't see the benefit for me to go through all of this extra effort and suffering and cost, for that matter, if I realize that, you know, maybe you're 7 years old or 75 or whatever your age may be, and you just say, if this is your will for my life, that I die from this illness, I'm willing to do that. So no, that would not be a sin. It certainly would not be suicide. But I make a distinction here between somebody who's later in life and somebody who doesn't have responsibilities, contrasted with a young mother or a young father who does. So let's say instead of 70 years old, let's say the father is 30 years old or 35 years old, and he gets brain cancer. Well, there are a few factors that enter into it now, it seems to me. So if he has children and he has his wife and he's there, it may be that the brain cancer would mean that he can't work anymore. I actually knew a man who was a little bit older than that, but not that much older, and he did die of brain cancer, and he left a wife and six, seven children, as I recall. And he just was simply, he couldn't survive it. The treatments they gave him, everything they did, he just couldn't survive it, and he died. So it's not as though he would be doing anything wrong if he said, I just want to let it take its course. If they said, this is inoperable and nothing we do is going to save you, it might prolong your life by 6 months or a month or something like that, then it's really kind of a judgment call, because if there's nothing that the doctors can do and you just say, well, let's just let it run its course, and you don't live that extra 6 months, it might have been nice maybe for your children or for your wife to have you around that much longer. But then there's the other question too, is what kind of suffering might that involve for them? If you're in a coma And, you know, there, that's another thing to take into account. So to kind of parse it down, I'll leave it at this and I'll throw it back to you, Doug. I think the dividing line is, if you can, if you have a reasonable chance of surviving a life-threatening illness by taking treatment, and you are young and you have responsibilities to a wife, to a husband, to children, they were depending upon you, they need you, even though you would not be committing a sin by saying, I don't want the treatment, and you allow nature to take its course and you wind up dying, it's far better if you're looking at this as a hierarchy of goods. It's a higher good to do what you can to beat the illness so that you can fulfill your obligations and be there for your wife and be there for your children. That's a higher good. So it seems that that's the way we should look at this kind of a scenario. What's the best thing to do in this situation? And for a young person with obligations, I think that is the best thing to do.
I understand. I lost my brother-in-law who went through a four-year process with cancer spreading and was at the Mayo and received a lot of great care. But eventually it took his life, and he put up a great fight. And you always hear about that, but maybe in, and that's a question too, in a longer circumstance that, you know, your oncologist says, well, you've got, you know, we can make you live at least maybe 4 or 5 years, you know, if we just do this, yeah, and this, but you're going to chemotherapy and you're miserable and you're sick and all of those kinds, yeah, of things. And so
those are all trade-offs. Yeah. They're all trade-offs. Right. And I haven't had to go through it yet. I don't know if I will or someone close to me will. I suppose eventually we'll all have to deal with something like this. So I'm speaking not from somebody who's gone through it, as you have. But that's the way I try to approach it. What is the best thing to do in this difficult situation? And if we can try to focus on that and weigh out all of the different options, I think we can come to a conclusion that, okay, in this scenario, this is the best thing to do. In that scenario, that's the best thing to do. All good stuff, Doug. Thank you so much. Let's go now to Larry in Lakewood, Colorado. Hi, Larry.
Yes, Patrick. I really enjoy your show. I think you're bringing Catholicism to Catholics who really need to know it. Anyway, my question is, what do you define as the definition of love?
By love, do you mean the feeling or the emotion of love, or do you mean charity in the biblical sense, that supernatural virtue?
Well, I think I mean what it would be toward your kids, when you love your kids, when you love your wife. What does that mean?
Okay. Well, the operating definition that I go by is that love is seeking the best for the other person, the object of your love. And very often, the best for that other person might be something that might be difficult for you. So like giving life to that other person involves the pain and difficulty of childbirth. That's a form of love. It's an expression of love. Getting up in the middle of the night to take care of a sick child when you'd rather be sleeping. That's a way of expressing love. So seeking the good of the other person in the truest sense, not what would feel good necessarily, but what is the best thing for you, and then being willing to do whatever you can to help that person achieve that good, that to me is the essence of love, the essence of charity.
Patrick, that's exactly how I would define it. I thank you very much. And I try to spread relevant radio to everybody I see. A lot have never heard of it. And
thank you.
I think this is teaching Catholics what they should to know, and that's not done today. So your show is great.
You.
All the hosts on all the show are fantastic. God bless you.
Thank you so much. Very kind of you to say so, Larry. And we take that to heart. All of us do here at Relevant Radio. Thanks for helping to spread the word. Have an email that came in from Laura listening in Minneapolis on 1330 AM. Hi, Laura. She says, I'm hoping you'll be able to offer me some advice. I experienced my first broken heart when I was 18. My best friend told me that he loved me, but could not commit to me. I felt hurt and blindsided, so I walked away completely. Since then, the heartache has led me home to the church, praise God. I no longer love this man romantically, but I do love him in the sense that I want what is best for him. This is interesting how it plays off what Larry was asking about love. She says, I am saddened by the fact that he has committed several mortal sins. He may die without sanctifying grace due to his lukewarm relationship with God. He is not in danger of death. However, he is a type 1 diabetic, and nursing and the nursing student in me is worried that something terrible will happen unexpectedly. 2 years have passed, and we only cross paths through mutual friends a couple times a year. I have not spoken to him otherwise. I want him to go to heaven more than I want him to be in my life. What do you recommend I do to help him come to know Christ, if anything? Or are my prayers for his conversion sufficient? Thank you so much for your time. Now, the headline of her email was Evangelizing an Old Flame, Yay or Nay. So the one area where I'm not entirely sure what you mean, Laura, is do you mean that it was 2 years now? It has been 2 years since he told you he loved you? In which case, I guess that would make you about 20 years old. Or do you mean that it was 2 years since the last time you saw each other? So I don't really know how much time has gone by, or, you know, are you two young people, or are you later in life? But I can understand your question. In other words, you want to help him, you want to do what's right for him because you have that kind of love for him. And I encourage you to do everything you can along those lines. Certainly pray for him, pray the rosary for him. And if there are things you can do that would be helpful, then do that. But if you're not married and he's not married and you're both in a position to get married, then there's certainly nothing wrong with you being more present in his life, even if it meant that those old feelings might stir up again. Could happen, hard to say. But if you're married, or if he's married, or if you're both married, then I think the prudent course of action would be to help from a distance. And you can be very effective from a distance. But if there's a danger that maybe an old flame might burst into flames again, and you're not in a position to do anything about it, then I would try to keep that at arm's length. That'd be my advice. Well, thank you. And I look forward to being with you again. You write quick, as they say. I will pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.